They've watched Citizen Kane a combined 200 times. Elliot's first words were, "I personally thought the use of Dutch angles was derivative in the 400 blows." In Nathan's favorite historical figure is Fritz Lang. Now they're bringing that snootiness to you with Magellan's at the Movies.
Welcome back, listeners and friends, family, countrymen, however the rest of that quote goes, Romans.
Friends, Roman, countrymen.
Thank you, thank you. Welcome back to Magellan's at the Movies. I am your host, Nathan Mogulyines, joined as always by also host Elliot Mogulyines. Elliot, the banter that I have for you, I'm going to talk for a bit, and then I will have a question for you at the end of my talking. So this week, yeah, I know you love this. This week is the Cannes Film Festival. We've got some exciting movies premiering here. Wes Anderson's new movie premiered. Richard Linklater's movie, New Wave, about the making of Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless. Premiered. It's supposed to be pretty fun. I'm kind of excited for that. It looks neat. Some other movies, Ari Aster's new movie premiered to dubious reviews and results. It looks like the front runners right now are some foreign movies. I'm sure, again, we've talked about this every year, but the movie that wins the Palme d'Or has been more and more relevant in Oscar conversations in recent years, to the point that, I don't know if you knew this, but Anora did in fact win the Palme d'Or and then went on to win Best Picture. So obviously it's having more and more of an effect. I think the three movies I've seen, or the three movies that I keep seeing people say have a really good shot at it, are Sentimental Value, which looks kind of neat. It's about kids reconnecting with their father or something. A couple of other foreign movies. And then the movie that I wanted to use to introduce my question to you. So Lynn Ramsey, bit of an art house favorite director, is back with a new movie, Die, My Love, with Jennifer Lawrence and Robert Pattinson. The movie is getting raves. Very positive reviews. Everyone's saying Jennifer Lawrence is incredible. Robert Pattinson is great as usual. But the thing I wanted to ask you is I've been seeing discussion about what the subject of the movie is about. That a lot of the reviews have been claiming that the movie is about postpartum depression, where after a woman gives birth, she has a bit of a downturn emotionally and mood wise and that the movie kind of goes through that sort of look. And the director has come forward in interviews as being very frustrated that this is what the critics are seeing in her film, because she doesn't feel like that is what the movie is about. So I wanted to ask you, Elliot, you know, do you think, who's at fault here? And maybe that, you know, I'm putting you in...
That's you gotta, a harsh way of putting it. Whose fault is this mess?
I guess, what do you think on the question of, you know, the director, the audience is seeing something that the director does not intend to be present in the film. Is that, you know, do you have a take on this as someone who, right, you read a lot of books, you're involved in literature and film, but what do you think as a creative about how much agency the audience has of determining what a piece of art is about?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that I don't put any stock or store in what comes out of Cannes, and frankly, neither should you, audience. Every year you see, like, oh, this movie that will end up getting panned by everyone else and making $3 at the box office got a 15-minute standing ovation. Wow. So yeah, whether or not this movie is any good, I don't think that Can tell us anything about that. I think I've said before that I typically lean death of the author on these types of situations. First of all, I'm not sure what she can do at this point. Like, short of recording, attaching a recording to the beginning of herself saying, hey, by the way, if you think this is about postpartum depression, you're wrong. Don't think that. I mean, there's no controlling where the audience goes. I don't know why how you would even begin to try to account for that unless you want to make it breathtakingly unsubtle. But I am sympathetic to this, honestly. Like, for the longest time, I think we might have talked about this when we reviewed The Shining. For the longest time, I thought that Stephen King's just being a big baby when it comes to that movie. But when I read The Shining for the first time, and it became rapidly clear that the book is about a flawed but fundamentally decent man being taken over by forces beyond his control. And it's a much more tragic story drawn from King's own experience with alcoholism and addiction. I can absolutely see being frustrated that then Kubrick comes in and makes it a bit more Kubrickian, by which I mean nihilistic and depressing and just more brutal and violent and less about the humanity at the heart of the story. So honestly, I'm sympathetic to both visions. Like, if I ever watch this movie, I mean, surely just listening to this is what it's about, that kind of takes the fun out of it for the rest of us. But I would want to hear, okay, well, what is it about? Or what was she intending this movie to mean and to say? And, like, if that's not present or doesn't seem to be present, I don't know. It's unfortunate, but, again, there's no accounting for what the audience will latch on to.
Yeah, I agree. Well, and it's not like the reviewers are misattributing things to it and then also saying, like, the movie sucks. Like, the reviewers really like the movie. It seems like the movie has a very good chance of being very successful critically this year. So I think that's interesting, but yeah, I don't put a ton of stock into what the director necessarily intended for a movie to be about, but I do, it's always enjoyable to watch a movie that I really like and then read an interview with the director and be like, oh, I like it even more now. Like, at first I thought it was about this thing, and then I read a review or an interview where they're explaining something, and I go, yeah, that's like even more potent or interesting than what I originally thought. I think Babylon, Damien Chazelle's movie from a couple of years ago, was a good example of this for me, that I watched it and I found it I found it really interesting. I really enjoyed it. I found it, it was a really enjoyable movie for me. And then I went and read some of Damien Chazelle's comments on it, and it made me enjoy it all the much more when he talked about, like, the propulsive energy of the film and his choice to not have an intermission in the film and just all of these different things that went into his vision for the movie. And I was like, yeah, I'm, like, picking up what you're putting down here, Damien. You're so true. You're so right. So that's always a lot of fun, to me at least. But, yeah, I guess you'll note I didn't say anything about standing ovations, because I agree that, you know, the standing ovations thing is ridiculous. I don't understand. I think one of the movies got, like, a 19-minute standing ovation, which I'm like,
That's just obnoxious.
That's what I'm saying. 19 minutes? Dude, you could have, like, gotten so much stuff done. It's like an episode of Gravity Falls, bro.
When you and I make our movie and we present it at Cannes and we get, like, right, an hour-long standing ovation, I think we should stand up and say, hey, shut up. Yeah. Stop it.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot to mention, also, Spike Lee's newest movie did premiere at Cannes to middling sort of reviews. I've read some that are very positive, but some are not as positive. So it seems as though it's not going to be, like, Spike Lee's masterpiece comeback film.
I didn't even realize he was in need of a comeback.
I mean, the Five Bloods did no numbers, did, like, negative press.
Well, it didn't help that it was a Netflix movie.
Yeah, well, it didn't help that it was, like, mediocre, too.
That's true. That
didn't help that it was also
weighing
great.
It down.
Yeah, Black Klansman is good, though, but yeah. Black Klansman. Anyway, so we'll keep you posted on some of these movies. Obviously, I think it's 2 weeks. Yeah, I think next. Yeah, 2 weeks from now, Wes Anderson's new movie will be in theaters, hopefully in Iowa. So, obviously, I'll let you know.
It's definitely going to be in Kansas City.
Oh, good deal. Good deal.
It's because everything comes to Kansas City, because it's just a big place.
Gosh. I have to drive to, like, Des Moines to see anything. It's so irritating. Anyway. Let's pivot over to the review portion of our movie review podcast. And we got a bit of a quirky film here, in the sense that we're throwing it way back on this one. We're reviewing a silent film. Back in the days of yore, we're doing Buster Keaton's Sherlock Jr., from all the, you know, the great stone face, as they called him, back in the day, in 1924 when this movie came out. And I think, before we jump into this, Elliot, have you seen a lot of silent films? Because we weren't really talking about this beforehand, but you mentioned when we were talking about recommendations, a couple of silent films that I have not seen and didn't know that you had seen. So have you seen a bunch of silent film? Like, what's your silent film knowledge coming into this review?
I don't know about a bunch. I've seen a handful.
Nice.
What's the difference between a bunch and a handful?
I don't know.
I've seen most of the classic Chaplin movies, like Modern Times, yeah, and The Gold Rush, nice, and other stuff that I'm struggling to remember.
City Lights?
I haven't seen City Lights, actually.
Oh, that's, I think, one of the classics.
Oh, well whatever. And I've seen Nosferatu.
Nice.
And I've seen The General from Buster Keaton.
Yeah.
And that's a Confederate version of a classic Union story, which is interesting. And I've also seen The Cameraman, which is slapstick Nightcrawler, and Steamboat Bill Jr.
Wow.
The other Junior one. So I have seen, I'm familiar with what a silent film is, how, yeah, it works, what it's trying to do, and how it usually tries to do that, especially this kind of pratfall heavy, slapstick heavy silent comedy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow, that's way more than I thought you would see. I mean, I'm in a similar camp to you. You mentioned a couple of Keaton movies that I haven't seen personally. I have seen City Lights. I've seen The Kid is the other Chaplin movie that I've seen that I think is kind of big. I've seen Nosferatu. I've seen Vampyr, the other vampire silent film. That one's a trip. That one's kind of funky. But yeah, like you said, silent movies were an interesting sort of period of film history because, you know, they didn't have sound, obviously, so that kind of limited, you know, this...
The hint is in the name.
Yeah, that'll really blow your gourd. But they had to tell a lot of their story in very broad strokes, and yeah, like you mentioned, most of them, certainly the Keaton and Chaplin ones, skewed towards pratfalls and, you know, things that just looked funny because that was the only thing that they were really operating on. And I think it's really, I always really enjoy watching silent movies because, you know, like, they're just discovering what you can do with a camera. And it's so fun to watch movies where they're, like, inventing a technique that you've probably seen hundreds of times. And, right, some dude thought of that. And here you're seeing the first time they used it. So that's really what's neat to me. But anyway, to talk about specifically, we're talking about, like you mentioned, Sherlock Jr. This is a Buster Keaton classic. Buster Keaton, one of the, I'd say, you know, him, Chaplin, and then Harold Lloyd, if you want to get really... I think kind of pretentious about it, but I've only seen one Harold Lloyd movie, so I'm not going to be standing up here and saying Harold Lloyd deserved to be on there. But yeah, Buster Keaton, Sherlock Jr., the movie follows Buster Keaton as a movie theater, looks like he's a cameraman. He runs the reels in a movie theater, makes sure they get changed on time, and he is trying to woo a girl. I don't know. It's a pretty basic setup for a story. The bulk,
especially for a silent movie. Yeah. Trying to woo a girl.
Yeah, they always be wooing women in these silent movies.
And all the women look exactly the same. Like, 1920s America had a type, and they rarely diverged from it in the movies.
Yeah, it's funny how similar they look, because it, and yeah, like you said, it has to be intentional. And I wonder if in, like, you know, 50 years, people will watch movies from the 70s in the same way, where it's like, dude, I can't tell Barbara Streisand and I'm trying to think of another 70s woman. It's not coming to me. Faye Dunaway. I can't tell Faye Dunaway and Barbara Streisand apart. Like, America, just like the same type of person. So I wonder if that's going to be present.
We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. To stay tuned to see if that's true.
Yeah, we'll pick up on this thread 20 years from now.
Yeah. But anyway, I'd say, you know, the, like any good Buster Keaton movie, the biggest show-stopping things here are the stunts. Buster Keaton did his own stunts of wildly with ridiculous degrees of, like, danger to himself. A lot of the things that he does, this is the movie, fun fact, that does contain a stunt where he breaks his neck and does not, like, he fractures a bone in his neck and he doesn't realize it for a couple of years until he, like, goes in for neck pains and they're like, yeah, that's because you broke it, bro. That's how they talked in the 1930s, by the way. But anyway, let's, you know, Elliot, where do you want to start with this movie? What do you think is the best way to start with reviewing a silent film?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard, especially with a movie like this, which is, we didn't even do initial impressions, but this movie is, if you didn't know, this movie is 90% dream sequence.
Yeah.
So 90% of this movie has nothing to do with the actual plot, which is a lot of fun, I think. I wish more movies were like that, honestly. And the movie's also 40 minutes long. So this is a 40-minute long fluff piece for Buster Keaton to just essentially mess around. It's interesting. It made me think, And I'm going to say something. Nathan, you're our film historian person, so I'm going to need you to correct me if I'm wrong here. But it made me think that this is the least like literature movies have ever been, was in the silent film era. Because this is people when the image, right, was the primary and almost only method of communicating information, and also people just like messing around with new stuff. So when you can make a picture move, you just want to kind of mess around with it, or they did at the time. Which leads to movies that have no plot and are basically just effects demos for the 1920s. So I guess what I'm rambling here is, what do you like about this movie? If you like anything at all, and you don't have to, obviously, but what do you like about this movie? What drew you to this movie? What made you want to talk about it?
Well, I wanted to do a silent movie because I think they are really interesting to review and certainly look back on. I think of them very similarly to trying to review or really critically appraise like Pong or the original Super Mario Brothers game. That it's like there's such a combination of creativity meeting the limitations of the technology of the time. And I think Sherlock Jr. is maybe the best example of that, or one of the really good examples of that, because a lot of Chaplin movies, I think, actually do a really good job of still telling a reasonably emotional sort of story, or at least having a story with some amount of drama. And there's other silent movies that have kind of survived the test of time because of their ability to communicate a really complex, nuanced sort of story. If you think of something like The Crowd or Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans, like those are those are two movies that are still praised today for being like very powerful like stories and, you know, kind of getting past somewhat the limitations. So I didn't want to choose necessarily one of those where
the good ones.
Well, because I think I really enjoy Sherlock Jr. because it's so fun to me to see the seeds of this art form that I love so much. And there's so many things in Sherlock Jr. that have stayed so present throughout the history of film. I mean, I think one of the front and center things that is really fun to me is how in the 20s, we've only been making movies for like 30 years. Like, we've only been able to make movies for 30 years at this point. And we've only been like genuinely pursuing it as an art form for like 10 of those 20. And already we're making movies about movies that are like meta and about, I mean, that sequence at the end of this film where Buster Keaton's character is like looking at the theater screen to see how he should be like interacting with his girlfriend to kind of like woo her. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that we still do. Like, we see movies that do stuff like that today. And so I think what I really enjoy about Sherlock Jr. is to see all of these seeds and see all of these things that would then, you know, just kind of generate these waves of influence all the way up to, I mean, I've talked about it on the podcast, right, that La La Land is one of my favorite movies of all time, and I think La La Land is building on that same framework of, like, we look at movies and we think this is what we need to be doing. Like, this is some sort of deeper truth that we can use in our lives, and here we have a movie that came out almost 100 years before that, forming that foundation of those same ideas. So that's why I picked Sherlock Jr. Beyond the fact that I think of all of these silent movies that are just kind of like hijinks based, I think the hijinks in Sherlock Jr. are top tier, in my opinion. top-tier hijinks movie.
Well, I'm going to ask you an important historical question. One of the most important historical questions you can ask when you're talking about history. Do you believe or know that this is what people are building on in the modern era? Or, because, like, just because something happens afterwards doesn't mean that what it's happening after is because, oh my gosh, I'm just terrible with words.
No, I get what you're saying.
Post hoc, ergo proctor hoc, is a logical fallacy. And I'm just asking, from genuine curiosity, is this, when people are making movies about movies, are they consciously or unconsciously building on something that began here? Or is this just significant mostly because Buster Keaton thought of it first or did it early, and it sort of grew as kind of a natural, people just like meta things? Like, meta commentary has been present in literature since Greek tragedies.
Well, you know, let me do something fun here. I can actually tie a direct line of influences from Buster Keaton, Sherlock Jr. to Damien Chazelle's La La Land. Fun fact.
That's fantastic. That is the gold standard of historical causation.
Because Woody Allen has gone on record saying that Buster Keaton walking into the movie in Sherlock Jr. in this film is what influenced his film, Purple Rose of Cairo, where I don't know if you've heard of this movie or you're aware of its premise, but...
Yeah, I'm aware.
If the audience is not, it's a movie where a woman keeps going to this movie that she really likes, and eventually she catches the attention of the character in the movie, and he walks out of the movie into the real world to, like, join her and woo her. And Woody Allen has gone on record that the idea for that, and then the idea for later in the movie, spoilers, the woman entering the movie with him as well, came from this movie. And... right, we could go one more. The montage sequence in the end of, and I have it, this is not confirmed, but it's so similar that it cannot be a coincidence in my mind. If it is a coincidence, then that's it crazy. Near the end of Purple Rose of Cairo, there's a montage where they do a bunch of, like, nightlife activities. That montage is almost shot for shot recreated in La La Land during the Someone in the Crowd musical sequence. So, is Sherlock Jr. as influential as I'm saying? I don't know. Like, I can't... I'd have to go and get the receipts of every director who's ever said, like, yeah, I did this meta thing because of Sherlock Jr. You're right. Meta elements in art are not new. I think it's kind of neat that it emerged, you know, maybe it's not that special, since if they were doing it in other types of art, why would they not do it in movies? But certainly Sherlock Jr. is one of the earliest examples of this. I think the way it does it is very novel, and certainly the movie's staying power, that it's one of the silent films that continues to be talked about, I think is indicative of directors continuing to go back to this and using it as a template, using it as a framework. And, you know, I can't, if you're looking for a doctoral thesis here, I could try and, you know, get every interview. But that was, there is a genuine connection between this movie and the movies that, you know, I cited there, which I think is really neat. I know we land on different sides of the fence in terms of this movie is an iconic influencer, ergo, it's good. I think we land on different sides of that. I don't think the argument is as simple as that, but you're kind of the movie should stand on its own two legs sort of guy.
What an insane concept.
And I'm kind of isn't this so cool kind of guy. But, you know, does that sort of answer your question?
Yes, and I think I'm just going to say what you've already said that I was going to say, or predicted I was going to say. Does that make the movie interesting from a historical standpoint? Yes. Mm. Does that have anything whatsoever to do with the movie's actual inherent quality? No, obviously not. We don't even need to have a discussion about that because everyone knows that the answer is no, right? I have a copy of the Epic of Gilgamesh. I don't have that because I think that's a fantastic story. I have that because I think it's interesting from a historical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that I don't think that this movie is good. Because this movie is definitely fluff, I think. But it's the most high-effort fluff I've ever seen. Because that segment that you're talking about, or that we're talking, that everyone talks about when they talk about Sherlock Jr.
Yeah.
When he jumps onto the movie, onto the screen. I mean, I'm human. I'm not immune to the key jangling effects of the simplicity of a cool effect or a cool image. That's good. That's good, right? That's good stuff right there. And then it's legitimately funny, albeit nonsensical. Nonsensical how he keeps on trying to orient himself, but the scene is changing. And within the meta-narrative of this movie, we've just transitioned to a montage of random shots, so that doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
But it's very funny, and it's just well done, especially when you think about how much work went into lining up these shots, because obviously you don't have CGI to fall back on. This is almost exclusively, from my understanding, and again, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, this is almost exclusively the work of editing and very precise camera placement to achieve this effect. And I respect that. I respect hard work. I respect stuff that looks good, and it does look good, and it's funny. But, like, who cares? Like, I like that. And I enjoyed watching this movie. I really did. I thought it was funny. It was probably the funniest of the Buster Keaton movies that I've seen.
Mm.
Because most of Buster Keaton's movies, the humor comes from fairly lengthy gags that boil down to Buster is physically harmed in some way, which I don't find particularly amusing. But this, I think, was a lot more clever. Like, when he's digging through the trash and he gets something stuck in his hand, so he hears someone coming and he puts his hand right down where they all step on it and get rid of it. That's clever and funny and has nothing to do with just Buster bumping into something or getting his head hit.
Yeah.
With a bag of sand. But at the end of the day, right, I just come back to the idea that this is a special effects demo.
Hmm.
And that's fine. That's interesting. That's enjoyable for what it is. But that puts a hard cap for me on how much I can enjoy it, because I just have no interest in images for the sake of images. Like, that, the idea is anathema to me, that because something looks neat, that's all that matters. Like, if something looks neat, why even bother having a story at all? Why not just make a special effects demo? Right? But, like, surely we can all agree. And maybe we can't. Maybe we can't. Nathan's going to say, Elliot, you idiot, I don't agree with that whatsoever. But would anyone out there agree that it would be better to have the cool images plus a great engaging story that makes you care about the cool images on anything deeper than a superficial this produces serotonin for me level?
Well, you know, obviously I'm not gonna argue that. Clearly, maybe not clearly, in my opinion, Star Wars A New Hope is better than Sherlock Jr. because, like you said, Star Wars A New Hope is pushing the envelope of what we can film and put in a movie, technologically speaking, and it is accompanying that with a fantastic story, with great characters that you care about. I do think it's a little, and this is kind of where it's tough for me sometimes to go back and review these movies, because I think a lot of these old silent films, right, the goal is maybe just to be 45 minutes of, dude, that guy just fell off a train. That's crazy.
I bet he broke his neck.
Yeah, like, and so it feels kind of, and, you know, again, this is me being nicer to the movie than Elliot would be inclined to be, because I'm kind of like, well, it feels bad to review it based on things that the director had no intention of ever attempting. That it's like watching Schindler's List and being like, wow, this comedy sucks. And it's like, well, that's not what he's going for, bro. Obviously, it's not exactly like that, but it feels similar to me. That I'm like, the way I review movies, I think, should be at least a little bit dependent on what the director is actually trying to achieve in me, the audience. And I think this movie is good to me because it is achieving what I think the director's intention is, which is, for 45 minutes, I'm like, that is funny that Buster Keaton is walking right behind the guy he's supposed to be shadowing, and he has not fully grasped that.
I really enjoyed that. That was really good.
That's a funny bit. And I also think, sometimes people will see some of these old silent movies and be like, wow, these, you know, like old people in the 20s were so stupid. They just like to see people slip on a banana peel. And it's like, look, kids today watch Minions, all right? And they find them funny. So let's not look back on past generations and be like, look, they were morons because they laughed at this thing.
It's getting steamed.
And like zoom in on the least funny joke in the movie. Because yeah, maybe there were some people in the audience who guffawed a little bit at Buster Keaton slipping on a banana peel. But there's some, right? I'm out here laughing because he does the, when he's looking through the trash and people keep coming up and like saying, hey, I lost a dollar in the movie theater. And the first one comes up and describes it or whatever. She's like, it's like this and this. And when the second person comes up, Buster Keaton like mournfully like describes it in the same way. I'm like, dude, that is a great joke. That is so funny. And that's a joke that, like, if it was in a movie that came out today, I would laugh at that. I would still laugh at that joke. There's so many jokes in here that I think are currently funny. I kind of went on a sidetrack, but
what I'm talking about is not so specific as wanting comedic elements in a movie about the Holocaust, which is a ridiculous analogy, by the way, or wanting dramatic moments in a movie about a guy dreaming that he's in a movie.
Yeah.
It's more like the idea that being a comedy somehow precludes emotional investment. I don't think I agree with that. Is that what you're saying?
No, not look, you know, I'm not gonna lie to you here. The weakest parts of this movie are the setup to the movie, and it could definitely be punched up, right? Like, I'm trying to think of other similar Because, like, The General is also a Buster Keaton movie mainly based on, like, hijinks. But it also does have a very coherent and clear storyline. It's not the strongest thing, but I do think it's a stronger through line than the through line in this movie. I mean, the setup to this movie is, one, very weak. Because it's just kind of... It's not even clear to me if we need this setup. Because I feel like having him just be reading a book about detectives and then, like, fall asleep and dream that he's in movies is a way stronger setup than he's reading a book about detectives and then he goes to see his girlfriend and, like, some hired hand frames him for stealing a thing and so they break up. What on earth are you talking about? So, I get what you're saying. Like, just because... it's a comedy, and just because it's a fairly simplistic comedy does not mean that they couldn't have put a better infrastructure around this kind of central conceit of Buster Keaton dreaming he's in a movie and, like, doing gags. Because I think certainly The General does a better job of that. Modern Times does a better job of having, like, a decently strong central story while also having, you know, Chaplin do some silly roller skating gags. I'm running out of examples because I haven't seen that many silent movies, but you get my point.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really like The General just because I don't really like Confederate revisionism. But... I was thinking when I was watching this that I think I like Chaplin movies a lot more than Keaton movies, because Chaplin movies typically do have an actual plot, and they're not really the best plots in the world, but it does go to show you how far you can get with minimal effort. Like, I don't think, and again, this is probably just my own bias and me just taking things too seriously, but I don't think it's too much to ask for a little bit of effort in the story department. And for me, being emotionally invested in a movie, that enhances all of its other aspects. Like, if I care about something happening, if I'm invested in the results of on-screen action, that makes me laugh harder and be more invested in fights and chase scenes and romance and all of that kind of stuff. Because if I don't care about anything that's happening, then I don't care. Like, how could I... What could be... what could be a more difficult obstacle to overcome for a story or a movie or a piece of art than not caring?
Yeah.
And so, honestly, I think it's testament to the quality of the gags that are here and the special effects that they do achieve that I liked the movie as much as I did, because this is a movie that I do not care about and that I cannot imagine myself ever rewatching. Because, I mean, it's like retelling the same joke over and over again. Right? Like, it just gets less funny. It can never be as funny as it was the first time, because you know what's coming and what else is there to get invested in? And, like, if I want to see him jumping into the movie screen, I would just watch it on YouTube. I wouldn't watch the whole movie for it. So I have completely forgotten where I was going with this. Nathan, you can say something now.
Well, and I think this is, you know, I feel like we're not talking about the movie a ton here. We're talking around the movie, kind of.
Well, because, it's 44 minutes of a dream sequence.
Well, and, you know, I've already mentioned a bunch of my favorite sequences in this. But I think for me, there is you know, you're talking about there's if the audience doesn't care, obviously, like, there's no worse death knell for a movie than that. And I think for me, there's never a point in this movie that I am not completely invested in seeing what is going to happen next. And even though I've seen this, this is my second time watching this movie, I still get such a kick out of seeing the gags, of seeing the effects. When Buster Keaton jumps through the guy's chest, what a stupid, what on earth is that? That's such a great, like, effect. It looks incredible. I've seen people explain how it's done, and I'm still like, dude, it looks amazing. I think he just actually did it. When he rides the train crossing thing to land in the guy's car, that's a crazy stunt. And I just, there's no, at least on rewatch, there was no diminishing return for me. I feel like I had just as much fun seeing what kind of camera tricks they had, of seeing the kinds of fun gags that they did, as I did the first time. I feel like, and this is a part of what I mean when I'm saying, like, a movie being iconic and meaningful makes me enjoy it more, which makes me rate it higher, because if I am enjoying the movie, then I'm gonna give it a better score than a movie that I don't enjoy. When a movie is iconic and influential, I just get such a kick out of seeing that stuff on screen and being like, this is so neat that, like, I'm sitting here 101 years after this thing is filmed and, like, watching it in a completely different context than anyone who worked on it or watched it when it was released could even, like, begin to, like, formulate. That, you know, no one on set was like, dude, do you think someone's gonna watch this on their computer streaming through a website in Ames, Iowa, 101 years from now? That's crazy.
You watch this on your computer?
I didn't watch it on my computer. I watched it through my computer into my TV. But that makes the movie more fun for me, being like, wow, this is such a neat, like, thing that I'm able to experience, and it adds to my enjoyment of the movie. And, you know, I get it. That's different for everyone, not every person. I'm sure if I showed this to, like, my wife, it would be an uphill battle to get her to care about the movie, because I'd be like, dude, isn't that crazy what they did? And she's like, I don't care, Nathan, let's watch Mamma Mia 2 or something. Because that's more enjoyable to her, right? Like, this is, you know, it's not a knock, movies are subjective, but I'm just saying, for me, I have such an enjoyable time watching movies like this that, you know, just have, are such a piece of movie history. It helps that I genuinely am enjoying every moment of the movie. Like, it's just fun.
I don't know, man. Like, that, that is just the statement, it helps that I'm enjoying the movie. That's a mind-blowing statement to me. Because, like, what else could possibly matter if you're not enjoying the movie?
Well, maybe I should flip it the other way. That I enjoy the movie, and then also the fact that it's iconic and influential adds to my enjoyment. Because, like, I do not like City Lights at all. That is, I think it's a stupid movie. I think it's one of the Charlie Chaplin movies that bites off either way more than it can chew, or just, like, has no idea how to chew. Like, it's taking a giant swing emotionally. And I've seen a lot of people being like, yeah, the final shot of City Lights is, like, crazy cinema. Like, that's so moving and amazing, and it's, like, better than all these other modern movies. I'm like, yeah, but you have to watch two separate scenes of the exact same stupid, unfunny gag. How is that fun? So, like, I have to enjoy a movie first, and then adding to my enjoyment is the fact that the movie is, like, such a, like, I'm adding on to, hey, this is so fun to watch. Hey, this is, like, influencing movies that I love. This is, you know, such a neat historical artifact. But if we don't have that bedrock of this movie is fun, or like I am finding a way to care about this movie, then obviously none of these other pieces are gonna fall into place for me. Because like with City Lights, that never happens. And I've seen people, like, it's Stanley Kubrick's favorite movie. I love Stanley Kubrick. That's a terrible choice, Stanley. That's a terrible pick. Pick something better, bro. Come on. You were alive when Star Wars Empire Strikes Back came out. Pick that.
Oh, yeah. Never meet your heroes or learn anything about them.
That's so true. We should change that. That it's not never meet your heroes. We should change it to, like, never Google your heroes.
That's true. If you Google Charlie Chaplin, you're going to find out some stuff, bro.
Do not Google Charlie Chaplin.
Unless you want to be disillusioned with him entirely, which I think is fine. Chaplin was a creep. Anyway. Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. It makes sense. It's something that I understand. It's just not something that I feel. And that's, like, we started off this whole episode with, there's no accounting for what the audience will latch onto. And honestly, this is, talking about movies with technological limitations, this is my emotional limitation. That I am, unfortunately, a literature person at heart. And literature is about narrative and characters. And so it's just a lot more difficult for me to be emotionally invested in the fact of the medium in the way that Nathan is. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just a difference of approaches.
I don't have a ton else to kind of add here, and I think I've mentioned all of my favorite gags from this movie, but did you have any other, like, things you would want to add before we get to a rating here?
No, I thought that him shadowing the guy was really funny, and well done on the blocking, guys, because that must have been a pain. Yeah, it's not like you can say anything about the acting. It's interesting because the silent movies are very theatrical with their acting because all you have is your physical performance.
Yeah.
So it's very exaggerated. And everything about it is theatrical because they're so heavily made up. Yeah. They have got to be wearing 2 solid inches of milk-colored foundation on their face so they don't look freakish, which they do kind of look freakish anyway.
Yeah.
What were you going to say?
I was just going to say, it's interesting how theatrical all of the silent movies were, and then Buster Keaton is famous for being deadpan, for having no emotions in any, like, he sometimes looked, like, quizzical, but that's about the most emotion you ever get out of him. Hence his nickname, the Great Stone Face.
Oh, I thought that's because his face is so weird looking.
I mean, that contributes, but it's mostly because his, like, character, the bit from his character, because all of these silent film stars, they played the same, like, you know, Charlie Chaplin is playing the little tramp in every one of his movies, and Buster Keaton is playing, you know, Buster Keaton in all of his movies, so all of them are, you know, kind of Keanu Reeves types. Blank-faced, dead emotions.
Zing. I don't know. Zing. I feel like the tramp is a lot more emotive than Buster Keaton.
Well, yeah, he is. Because, like, his deal is that he's just, like, poor and kind of, like, put upon.
Yeah, he's very hassled.
Yeah. Buster Keaton is, like, he barely escapes death, and then he just kind of looks befuddled. Like, he has no emotion about the fact that he just almost died.
Yeah, I think because Buster Keaton was the child of vaudeville.
Yeah.
And I don't know that much about vaudeville, but I seem to remember or seem to have this kind of impression that the straight man is a part of vaudeville. Sure. The person who's not reacting.
That or makes sense.
Who is kind of like vaguely befuddled, but not really. Right, the famous stunt from Steamboat Bill Jr. Yeah, yeah, Steamboat yeah. Will Jr. when the Bill. Facade falls around him
yeah.
and he just kind of looks around rather than screaming. That's the kind of muted reaction.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that is part of vaudeville.
Well, and even his reaction, like in this movie, when it's flipping through all of the different like locales in the movie and it flips to like a bunch of lions and he just kind of like goes yeah. to like hide in a bush. Instead of doing anything else. Like, that's a classic, I think, Buster Keaton sort of thing. But anyway, let's get to ratings then. Sounds like we're kind of closing up shop here, review-wise. Yeah, I'm going to give it an 8.5. I really enjoy this movie. I get a kick out of watching it. If you've never seen it, I am almost positive that you can just, like, look it up on YouTube because it's in the public domain by now because it's 101 years old. So you should watch it if you haven't watched it. It's a light, breezy sort of affair. I am almost positive that there's at least one moment in here that you're going to say, that was funny or, you know, that was neat. So I get a kick out of it. That's my score.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a C+.
Holy cow.
And this is one of those ones where I'm really torn between a plus or a minus, by which I mean a low grade plus or a high grade minus.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, like, and this is another one of those reviews where I feel like I've poorly represented my feelings on the movie because I do get enjoyment out of some of the gags and the trick of him in the movie. But ultimately, I just keep on coming back to, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like Tommy Lee Jones in The Fugitive. I don't care. It's like Buster Keaton is saying to me, I did that all without CGI. And I say, I don't care.
Wow, good bit, Elliot.
Great. Impression of Tommy Lee Jones.
Second week in a row you've brought up The Fugitive. Jeepers.
The Fugitive is a good movie. Also with iconic bits, which means Nathan automatically loves it. it's really just, if you don't care, then what are you supposed to say? What am I supposed to say? Like, yeah. I don't care. I don't care about it, and the fact that it is able to wrestle a C+ out of me is a testament to the quality of its special effects and its humor, because without those, I think this would be, or if they weren't at the level that they're at, then this would be a much, much lower rating.
Hmm. All right.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, I agree with Nathan. Watch it for yourself. Find out for yourself. It'll take you 44 minutes. If you Google it, you can watch it on its Wikipedia page.
Yeah. And actually, most of the movies we've mentioned today, I think you can Google and look up on the Wikipedia page. Because, again, they're all, like, over 100 years old. So.
That's, yeah. When I worked at the library at Simpson, what I would do is I would just watch silent movies on my computer on Wikipedia.
Yeah. Dude, that's when I watched Sherlock Jr. for the first time at Simpson.
Oh my gosh. Here you go.
Anyway, let's get to some recommendations here. I'm going to recommend one of the few, actually, silent movies that I have not talked about up to this point, and that's going to be F.W. Murnau's, I don't know if I pronounced his name right, but The Last Laugh, which follows a kind of put-upon old man as he is kind of in the waning years of his time as a kind of bellhop at a hotel, I think is what his job is. But like all good silent movies, it's about kind of the slow end of an old guy's life. It's a bummer of a movie, not all the way through, but it is, if you're looking for a silent movie, like Elliot's talking about, that's taking a bit of a bigger narrative swing. I think, for my money, The Last Laugh is the best of the silent movies that I've watched up to this point. It is a very emotional story. It's very well done. Some genuinely, like Elliot said, silent movies are very theatrical, but I think this one does a really good job of already starting to kind of like point you towards the type of acting that would eventually become the, I'm trying to think of a fancy word to say here, but the norm in movies, this more nuanced sort of acting. And yeah, it's just, it's really good. You should watch it. It's almost undoubtedly available free somewhere on the internet. So yeah, The Last Laugh is going to be my recommendation.
Well, that sounds great. Why didn't we review that?
Because then no one would listen to our episode, Elliot. We're hemorrhaging viewers. We have to choose popular films and then recommend artsy films.
Wow. I didn't realize that was our strategy. Okay, well, I've never heard of that, but that sounds fine.
It's good.
My recommendation is also going to be a silent movie. It's going to be The Circus. This is probably my favorite of the Chaplin movies, which I know is not the standard pick. But for my money, this is the movie that does the best job of marrying the kind of, I don't know, tragedy. Tragedy is a bit of a strong word, but the misfortune of the tramp character with some actually good gags. And Chaplin was never, in my experience, as into the stunt side of things as Buster Keaton was, but this movie does have some impressive choreography, and I guess you would call it stunt work. But it also has gags that extend beyond "I've been wounded, har har," and it ends on a surprisingly sweet and affecting note. So, yeah, that's my recommendation.
Interesting. I haven't seen The Circus. I want to see it, because that sounds kind of similar to Charlie Chaplin's The Kid, which is probably my favorite Chaplin movie, which also kind of ends on a earnest sort of note. I don't know why people are so nutty about City Lights. When he was doing this, like, end on an earnest note thing with all of his other movies, like, people get really nutty about that one, but Modern Times, The Kid, The Circus, all of them end on a fairly earnest note. The Gold Rush doesn't, but that doesn't matter.
Well, that's true. The Tramp, like, the movie called The Tramp, ends with him. I mean, it's not earnest, it's just like a little bit sad, or it's supposedly sad, but I mean, he spent the entire movie basically harassing people, so I wasn't really saddened by it. But I'll tell you what I am saddened by: life. Because life is hard and full of disappointments, and it makes people sad. It's just the truth of the matter.
That's true. Anyway, be sure to send us an email if you have if you're a film historian and we got something way wrong in our assessment. We're both, I would say, amateur to
laymen.
Yeah, whatever the is below an amateur when it comes to film history. So if I got something way off, please email us and we'll be happy to run a rescinding of some of our comments. Yeah, correction. But otherwise, we're going to be back next week. We're going to be here with another new movie to review. It could be a movie that you love if you send us an email and request that movie. We love honoring requests. So until then, we hope you have a great week, and thanks for listening.